Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight is a particular honor for me because, let's face it, my presence on this stage is pretty unlikely. My father was a foreign student, born and raised in a small village in Kenya. He grew up herding goats, went to school in a tin roof shack. His father, my grandfather, was a cook.
Welcome to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time, 5 o'clock Eastern. We are the number one resource for small business and nonprofits. To learn how you can showcase your business or nonprofit, go to our website at TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com for details. Man, we have another great show in store for you today. So sound the alarm. Get on Facebook, Twitter, Foursquare, or Tumblr. Send out emails and text messages. Call your friends and family and tell them to tune in right now to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. And for those of you that are listening via Blog Talk Radio, leave your comments. Click the follow button or follow me on Twitter, and that's at TaylorMade101. I'll be reading your tweets live on the air. And I also have a chat room open. Out there in the chat room, you can leave your comments or ask questions. So whatever your pleasure, chat room, Twitter, Facebook, or just plain old my bell, we want to hear from you. But first, let's take a look at the current events. Salutations, everyone. Greetings and salutations. We have another great show in store for you today. So let's take a look at what's on tap. It looks like there are more police shootings of black males. So I pose the question, why are police compelled to shoot blacks? More specifically, why are police compelled to conduct acts of violence against black? Is it open carry for whites and open season for black? We take a look at that in a lot more detail. We also, Nancy Wrightball and Dr. Kent Brantley have walked out of the Emory University Hospital in Atlanta infection-free from the Ebola virus. We take a look at that. And also much more. So to join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. And now to help me break all of this down is the executive producer of Current Events and the chief operating officer of Cook Enterprises. I introduce to some and present to others no other than Jima Hill Cook. Jima, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Let me start by talking a little bit about your book. You have a book signing coming up here in the days to come. And first, kind of tell the audience a little bit about your book and then talk about what the event is coming up here shortly.
So the title of my book is entitled Reflections, What I Know to Be True. And it is a 30-day devotional for men or women that takes you on the journey, different lessons that I've learned throughout my life. And it talks about relationships. It talks about managing your skill set, knowing who you are, knowing what your purpose is and walking into that purpose. It also talks about dealing with loss and grief, and not just loss and through death, but, you know, loss of a friendship or the ending of a relationship. And it talks about just what I've learned on this journey, what the lessons I've learned, the things I take away with me, the lessons I had to relearn. And I try to tell the story in such a manner that everyone can relate to it on some kind of level, whether it's through an antidote in terms of one day is entitled in the fire. And I often talk about how if we're never put in the fire, we never will become what we're supposed to become. And the example I often use when I talk to people is I talk about, you know, mixture of cornbread or when you're baking a cake. If you put all the ingredients together, you mix it all up, and you leave it on the counter, that the cake doesn't become the cake until it's placed in the fire, until it goes into the oven. And that's how we are. God has to place us sometimes in the fire to get out of us what he's already put in. So you've already put everything into that mixture. You put the eggs and the butter and the cream and the chocolate and whatever you're going to make it be cake or whatever you're making to be cornbread. But in order for it to be what its intended purpose is, it has to go in the fire. And so, you know, that's simple. People can visualize that. They can see that. That makes sense to them. And so, you know, how many of us have just allowed ourselves to have things poured into us and we're just sitting on the counter? We haven't placed ourselves in the oven. We haven't placed ourselves in the fire. Or we've come out of the fire too soon and we weren't done all the way through. And so that's one of the lessons that I talk about. And so the event on Saturday, August 30th, from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., it is going to be here in the Woodbridge community in Faxe, Wiley area at the Woodbridge Golf Course. And what I will do and hopefully is have people just ask questions. We will read their favorite passage from the book and ask me questions about it. I will read several passages from the book as well and discuss, you know, what my motivation was at that time. And even go back and reflect over some of my own thoughts that I have had since writing and since being published. So I'm excited about it. I'm hopeful that people will come out and share in yet another part of my journey and to be there to support in such a manner. And if you haven't purchased the book, that's fine. You can still come out and listen and be a part of the audience, and books will be there to purchase at that time. So I don't want that to be the reason that someone doesn't come because, oh, well, I hadn't had a chance to buy the book yet. That's okay. Come on out and enjoy the fellowship, the friendship that will be there and a little bit of food for the body as well. And you can purchase your book on site.
That's awesome. I guess we'll be talking more about that later on in the show. And so I just wanted to kind of get the early listeners out there an opportunity to kind of understand what we're doing this weekend and give them an opportunity to participate. So without further ado, I want to talk a little bit about these shootings. Two more shootings. Actually, there are several more, but I want to talk about two specifically. John Crawford III was shot in a Walmart after police received a 911 call. And a 25-year-old K. Powell, was shot and killed less than 4 miles from where the police shot and killed 18-year-old Michael Brown. Now, what's interesting, and I want to kind of cover both issues. Now, the second case I just brought up, 25-year-old K. Powell, that was shot. The footage was released immediately, relatively immediately after the fighting. I mean, after the shooting. Now, as a consequence, there was no uprising. There was no violent or deviant behavior. There were no protests. And I'm not real sure if there was a correlation between the amount of information that was released and the violence or the lack of violence portrayed by the community. But what I can say, and is what I said in the past, that, people just can't be going out and causing police or agitating the police. Now, granted, Now, I want to make sure I get that out in the atmosphere first. Don't go out stealing, robbing, killing, shooting, breaking the law, basically, and agitating the police to cause them to react in a certain way. Now, having said that, the video portrayed this young African-American male, 25 years old, relatively young. I want to say his name, Kajimi Powell, walks into a store, and he was acting kind of erratic, you know, had a very erratic behavior, stole some items, but he did not run away. He put the, can of soda, I think he had taken from the store on the ground. He went back in the store and pulled another one out and put it on. So he was actually trying to say, come and get me. He waited some time for the police to come or for someone to call 911. Quite natural, the police responded. And what's interesting after that is that the whole situation takes a kind of a weird turn. The weird turn was that as soon as they were out on the scene, they pulled out their guns immediately, and then they saw this young man walking around, and then he had his hand in his pocket. He pulls his hand out of his pocket. He has some object in his hand. Let's assume the object was a knife. Certainly was not a gun. Certainly was not threatening or pushing, you know, in a stabbing type motion towards, at least based on the video that I saw. So after all of this had taken place, within a matter of 23 seconds, the police pulled out the gun and shot and killed him. And let that marinate for a minute. Goes into the store, takes two sodas out of the store, sits them down on the ground, waits for the 911 call. Police arrive on the scene. As soon as they get out, they pull the gun. They tell him to take his hand out of his pocket. He pulls his hand out of his pocket. He, Kajimi Powell, he says, shoot me, and they shot him. They accommodated him. So the question I pose is, why are police compelled to shoot blacks? Now, I'm sure there is a degree in which a police officer should engage an individual. There should be a progression of activities that they take place. If not, then we really need as a community or a society to really revisit how we are, how our policing activities are. Now, granted, if you pull up on the scene, somebody's shooting at you, yeah, you pull out your weapon, you exchange fire. But if a person is acting in a sporadic behavior way, in a manner, and, you know, obviously something is wrong with them, it to me is far and far between than I go out and just try to automatically engage them with a gun. You know, what happened to the tasers? Whatever happened to talking the person down, or whatever happened to assessing the situation, as opposed to just shooting this man down? And what's interesting in this case, just like the Eric Garner cases, the entire event was captured on film from start to finish. Even before the police arrived, the guy was filming, he was of the mindset, yeah, this guy is acting crazy, the police are going to come, they're going to arrest him, they're going to take him in for acting crazy. But lo and behold, what they captured on video, and it's all over the web, and they shoot and kill him. So, Jima, so let's start with 25-year-old, and I'm going to say his name, Kajimi Powell, that was shot and killed by the policeman. You know, why are police so compelled to take out their weapons and shoot blacks?
Well, it goes, I can't answer that. I mean, I'm trying to come up with an answer, but I don't really think I can.
When I look at, I thought about this in some great detail, and I looked at the fact that we are conditioned to respond based on the situation. Our brains are conditioned to respond based on or react to a certain situation, right? If I'm walking down the street and I see a bird or a rabbit, I will respond differently than if I'm walking down the street and I see a snake. Now, both of these are animals. Both of them could be seemingly harmless, But the fact that I have been conditioned to respond differently to a snake than I would be to a rabbit, I'm going to automatically get on defense as soon as I see a snake. Or if it's the case, I'm walking down the street and I see a dog or a cat, and I'm walking down the street and I see a lion or a tiger, I'm going to respond differently in both cases. And the reason why I respond differently is because of my brain has been conditioned. I understand the violent and deviant behavior that a tiger, a lion, and a snake will cause because of what I've seen, what I've viewed, what I've been conditioned to know about those two animals. So when I come up on a situation, or when police come up on a situation where they see an African-American, they automatically are conditioned to respond or to behave in a situation that is similar to how they would respond to a tiger, a lion, or a snake. Because it certainly can't be because it's an individual that has a knife. Because I've seen similar situations, similar cases where the police did not respond automatically with their weapons drawn. There's a video out on the web, and this is an interesting study that was done by a white and a black man. And they were out, trying to get into a car. Both of them have a Jimmy. So when the white guy is, you know, trying to get in the car, the alarm is going off. You had very few people even look his way. You know, so he did this for about 30 minutes. A police car pulls right up next to him and still did not behave in any threatening or defensive manner. 30 minutes later, an African-American conducted the same activities. Pulls into a car with a Jimmy, goes down to the window. I'm talking about minutes later, you had four or five policemen surround the guy. Not only did they surround him, they put him up against the wall and handcuffed him and then asked him about the car later. So it goes back to this notion of being conditioned to respond to African Americans differently than you do to others. And I see this behavior that's conducted to all minorities when it comes to Mexicans are treated the same. They're just not as a frequent occurrence because at least I don't see it as often. So do you understand, you know, where I'm going with this, Jima, and why I see it in this way?
I do understand. And that's why it's hard to really explain it. I mean, I don't want it to be as the data shows it to be, that just based purely on race and based purely on how people have been perceived and described over the course of history, that just based on that alone has caused people to respond and react a certain way. And that's just, I mean, short of is not fair, but that's the reality. And so, you know, how can we expect to be treated fairly and equally by local law enforcement when those are the perceptions out there about us? It's hard.
And not to mention, you know, we contribute to those images. Now, I'm going to say this because I'm a big proponent of sifting through the media for what you see, because there are images out there. There's certainly a lot more negative images out there being portrayed of African Americans than there are positive images. And so we have to make a concerted effort to at least look for those positive images or portray them. You know, when I look at my Facebook page periodically, there's always some ignoramus people, if that's a word, on Facebook, you know, doing stupid things, you know, whether it be, you know, making fools of themselves, dressing a certain way, saying stupid things. And we kind of perpetuate that, right? And so then if you take it from just your immediate Facebook page, not saying that this is what the pictures of the silver screen of the big screen are portraying. This is not to say that the magazine, because I'm gonna get there too, This is not to say what the sitcoms that we see all put us in this image, and so it's conditioning the world to say this is who you are, and this is who we believe that you are because this is what we see every day. Because if I don't live in a neighborhood next to an African American, I don't go to the same school system, I certainly do not attend their same church, then I have to rely on the images of who they are being portrayed to me, you know? And so we perpetuate it on our Facebook page, we perpetuate it on our Twitter page, then Hollywood perpetuates it by the movies that they portray us as. And so in a lot of ways, life imitates art, or art is imitating life in this particular instance, because this is who people are. So if I go around and I know snakes bite, so I very rarely see a snake, a pet snake, where a person is loving them and feeding them. I very rarely see a lion, you know, being fed and cuddling up with people, and tigers and things of that nature. When I see them, they're vicious. They're mean. They roar. They're heavy. You know, they're big and tall and fat and fast and strong. So quite naturally, I'm going to be defensive when I see one. So in a similar manner, when African Americans are being portrayed as deviant, thugs, you know, real hostile, mean, the angry black man, the angry black woman, violent, aggressive, overly sexualized. When I see these things, I have to defend myself because this guy is going to get me. Mm-hmm. And so I think when we see these images, when the police sees these images, this is the self-conscious that's playing out in all of these situations. Is it right? No. No, by no stretch of the imagination am I saying it's right. I'm just saying it has a lot to do with it. A lot to do with it. What do you think?
I agree. Well, I mean, I can't, you know, say anything different than what you said, you know, in terms of based on what people are inundated with on a daily basis of the negative images. And then, as you stated, the personal responsibility of the images we portray of ourselves and we feed into the nonsense, then when we are approached or in large gatherings, people always have some idea about what's going to happen or what's not going to happen. We are, you know, I don't know if you've ever been followed around in the store. I have, for no other reason than the fact that I'm a black female, and probably in a store they don't think I'm supposed to be in. And so when you're there, or even if I'm in Walmart, it doesn't have to be a high end store. And you're either overlooked or over scrutinized. Either one, it's either end of the spectrum. They either act like you don't exist, or they follow you around all day to make sure you're not taking nothing. And so, just merely based on, oh, these people do this, these people do that, and like you said, we don't help the matter when we perpetuate some of those same stereotypes on a daily basis. Like you say, on our Facebook page, on Twitter, all these crazy videos people be doing it themselves, and I just want to know who are those people, because I don't know people like that. So I'm trying to figure out where are these people living and what's going on in their world.
And those are the images that goes viral, right? I mean, it was interesting is when I see a picture on my Facebook page that's not of African American, and if it's of another race, especially the majority race or the white race, I see a nice little white girl, I see a nice little baby doing these things, and they playing and they having fun. But when I see us, boy, it's ugly. Either they crazy out of their mind, they doing something stupid, or the fight pictures, right? I'm walking up and I see a video. You know, now Facebook has it where you don't even have to click on the video before you still start seeing it. So if I'm scrolling down my page, it automatically start playing. So it's not that I'm drawn to this. Now it's being pushed on me. And I'm saying to myself, if I have friends on Facebook page that's sharing these type of things, I can need to get rid of them. Because obviously their mind is not conditioned to kind of help the cause, right? And so what's interesting to me is, again, when I think about the lion, the tiger, and the snake, and how I've been conditioned to be defensive, to make sure I put up my guard, or if I have a weapon to protect myself. I believe it's the same images that are being portrayed of us that make people want to do harm to us when they see us. And what's interesting is, if you really search your soul, and if you're out and about and you see a large gathering of African-American young people, you get defensive because you don't know. Because there has been so many images being portrayed of them in a negative manner, it's hard to see them doing some positive. And even when we were at the church this summer doing a summer program, you know, even though they were not violent, they still were deviant in a lot of different ways. And so, again, we help to perpetuate this notion of ignorance, not employed, or not being productive citizens, not voting, not participating in the economy, all of these things. And so, you know, and not to justify what Darren Wilson does, but this is just the reality. I mean, we really need to take off. We really don't need to miss this opportunity when it comes to making sure that we make the necessary corrections to our images, so that we can be really perceived as humans, as people. And so you won't have situations like this next story I want to cover. So we were talking about 25-year-old Kay Powell that was shot by the police because he went into a store, took two cans, and then within 23 seconds, the police shot and killed him. I mean, no explanation at all. I mean, he did have a knife. He did steal something. But is that the reason to kill the young man? No, absolutely not. So, again, we do have some responsibility. First of all, he shouldn't have went and stole anything. I'm going to always say that. But now, let's take a look at the other side of the coin. John Crawford III was shot in a Walmart after police received a 911 call. And so, a lot of people are quick to take a look at this case and saying, yeah, this is another erroneous killing of an African-American, but this is worse. And the reason why this is worse is because of the law. So there's an interesting story written by Albert Butler on The Root. And it reads, "Is open carry for whites and open season for blacks?" So what if the police thought the toy gun he was holding was a rifle when they shot and killed him? And where he was shot, Ohio is an open carry state. Let me let that marinate for a minute. Ohio is an open carry state. Now, while the attention on America and the world, for that matter, is on the demand for answers about the death of an unarmed 18-year-old in Ferguson, I want to take a moment to discuss another officer-involved shooting that happened 4 days before Michael Brown was gunned down and murdered in the streets in broad daylight. Now, John Crawford III was shot in a Walmart after police received a 911 call alerting them that a man with a rifle was walking around the store. Officers arrived on the scene and, after a brief encounter, shot the 22-year-old man, who later died of a gunshot wound to the torso. As we now know, Crawford was holding a Crossman MK-177 air pump rifle, a non-lethal replica air rifle intended for a child. And it was sold at the very store where he was shot while carrying it. So pause there for a minute. Just to imagine, it's Halloween, you go into Walmart and you pick out a Superman cape, or you pick out a pumpkin, or you pick out some candy. You walk around in the store with the items that you pull out the shirt because that's what you do. Much of the focus of this discussion around the case has been on this fact. Why would police shoot a man holding a child's replica gun in the store that sold it? That's a fair question to ask. But the context of what we're going to discuss today is the fact that Ohio is an open carry state. So even if Crawford, the young man, were carrying a real, fully loaded rifle, why would they raise any alarms? How could that possibly be a reason to kill him? Now, let's just marinate for a second. Now, of course, the law varies from state to state, but Ohio's open carry law means an individual can possess a firearm without a permit in most public places, including stores. So as long as it's fully visible, in fact, in Ohio, you only need a permit if you wish to conceal a gun. That means if you want to walk around with an AK-47, AR-15, or even a Remington 870 pump-action shotgun, no problem. So as long as you don't conceal it or go around threatening people with it. Which brings me back to John Crawford. He was holding a toy gun in the store that sold it. And even if it were holding an honest-to-goodness rifle loaded with real bullets, he was well within his Ohioan rights to do so. Who was he threatening? We've seen open carry activists all over the country walk around in public and visit major chain stores without so much as a police scolding them, let alone confrontation with the police or an actual shooting. So, Jima, why is it again, I move back to the original question, why are the police compelled to shoot African Americans?
And I still don't know if I have a good answer for you, because when you look at what you just stated, all of the information you've given, you have to now go back to the person that made the 911 call there in Ohio. The ex-Marine, what made him call the police about somebody in Walmart with a gun? Was it just because he was a black man? You know, the question becomes, had you seen a white man walk around with a gun in Walmart, would you have called? And Walmart is one of those stores that do allow you to walk around with a gun, as is several other places, Kroger's and Hobby Lobby. I mean, not Hobby Lobby, Home Depot. You know, Hobby Lobby might, I don't know. But I know, you know, so it goes back to your question. Would he have had the same response had it been a white person walking around Walmart in the toy section of the toy store with a gun? Would he have thought that it was a real gun at that point? Or would he have recognized, oh, I'm in the toy section, this is probably a toy gun? And this is would he have put a little bit more thought before he made a 911 call? And what about that sent police back to the back of the store? Because most of the times in most Walmart, your toy department is usually in the back of the store to the far right or far left when you walk in. Don't ask me how I know that, but, you know, I just do. So, you know, how would they come in, guns a-blazing, running to where this alleged crime is taking place, and the people in Walmart don't even know? And you didn't get a call from Walmart. You got a call from somebody in Walmart. There's thousands of cameras in Walmart. There's secret security walking around Walmart. And you mean tell me this is the only person that felt the need to make a call and that the police didn't have enough in them to stop and ask on their way to the back? I mean, you know, I know it's a split decision and all of that, but come on now. Where does common sense play in when you're a police officer? I haven't seen that happen lately.
And so what's interesting, too, though, you're also putting other customers at risk. Yeah, you're really
right.
Putting it's so much that was involved in this particular instance. Now, I kind of gave a dissertation on the case before when the guy was clearly acting outside of the law. He was clearly agitating the police officers, which quite naturally shouldn't yield that type of results. It shouldn't yield a shooting out of that, but, you know, they did. Right. But this particular case, when the law was on his side, when the fact that, you know, if the weapon was seen threatening, then the law is that you change the law. But he was certainly within his right to do so. And then come find out that the gun was a toy gun, not even a real one. And you gun him down.
Right, and I think the other thing, though, is that even with the young man you mentioned that was taunting the police, and listening to different shows and police officers calling in, a lot of them have stated that, you know, shooting is the last resort and not the first one, because you have a graduated use of sanctions and forms to subdue someone besides shooting them if you're not in imminent danger. And the guy wielding the knife, and which wasn't a machete or hatchet or a saw or, you know, anything such as that, it turned out to be a steak knife. I'm not saying that's not dangerous, but, you know, it's two officers with guns and tasers and batons, and you got all these other things, and it was two of y'all. You mean neither one of you all could think about how to subdue him without shooting and killing him? I mean that's the other thing. Let's just fire off all these bullets. So even though he was doing what he was doing, I still think the officer has a responsibility, if his life is not in immediate danger, to find other means to subdue someone outside of just shooting them dead. I think there's supposed to be some other steps before you pull out your weapon if you're not in immediate danger.
And that's certainly the position I'm taking, too. I mean, there has to be a graduated scale or a progression of activities that you must take prior to just taking out your weapon and shooting someone. I mean, because that's really a license to kill. Now, again, I'm going back and say, that doesn't mean people go out there and steal. That doesn't mean people go out there and commit crimes. But it seems like it's the case when a person, even if was not committing a crime, acts of violence against African American is the norm. And you know, certainly over the last several weeks, and we talked about this, you know, several weeks ago, every week, you know, there has been a police shooting killing an African American male. Every week since we started talking about it. And so without fail now, so again, you know, one could say there's an increase, and again, I have always, you know, stated my position. I have no data to substantiate the exponential growth in shootings, but it's certainly I'm being made more aware of it. The media is certainly being made more aware of it. So obviously, you know, there has to be some increase, even if the increase in just telling people or recording them, certainly an increase. And so I think policing has to be addressed nationally as opposed to being looking at these as an isolated incident, because you can't have this number of cases that happen and it's considered to be isolated incidents.
Right. And there has been, and I'll try to find it before the end of the show, but there has been a report that was generated this week. I don't know if it was from the ACLU or another group that put together the data of the number of shootings by police officers on black unarmed men. They was that specific in their study. So I'll try to find that here and be able to talk and give that information out.
Okay, sounds good. We're going to take a quick break. And when we return, we're going to talk a little bit about the activities in Ferguson over the last couple of weeks. Certainly, there's a St. Louis County officer suspended for some racist rants. There's been a lot of some attempts to discredit the eyewitnesses. So I wonder, are they kind of trying to say black people are liars now? And so we'll talk about this and much, much more when we return. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Be back in a moment.
You are listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas. My mom and dad will be right back after these messages. Cook Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our company's tailor-made training and consulting, Current Events, and Ask Jima can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for discounted books for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. But I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, Ask Jima. And Ask Jima says, Reverend Al, today is my birthday, and I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online, driving people around me crazy. And I want to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday. That's my friend. And of course, my East Boom.
Need a new website? Haven't figured out your social media strategy? Are you finally ready to tweet, post, or blog? Well, look no further. Go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. We are the number one resource for small businesses and nonprofits. We're a full-service, interactive consulting firm specializing in social media marketing, web design, technology workshops, as well as leadership and management training. So go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. Google me.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. I want to shift now back to what's happening in Ferguson, Missouri, primarily because we've had several days of some peaceful protests. The numbers of people that were involved in arrests has diminished tremendously. It seems like the people are having an opportunity to do some protesting, to voice their opinions, get involved in the situation, and certainly being able to at least have their voices heard. And speaking of having their voices heard, there was a St. Louis County officer suspended for saying some outlandish things. Now, I don't know if you've heard this, but a Missouri police officer involved in maintaining security, as is mentioned, was put on administrative leave after a video surfaced showing him railing, voicing his opinion, as I should say, about the Supreme Court, Muslims, and his past, and perhaps, he said, his future as a killer. There have been a couple of videos that has surfaced capturing these police officers saying some crazy things. And what's interesting, I don't know if you were able to notice, if you go back and look at the footage over the last couple of days, you'll notice that there the badges and the name tags of the police officers have been removed. So it's certainly more difficult for you to identify the police officers and then being able to reconcile maybe who they are, what division they're from, what shift they work, things of that nature, because they're removing identifying marks over the past few days. Now, Gene, what do you make of, the actual video that surfaced about this police officer and the fact that they were removing the name tags and badges?
Well, you have to wonder why they were removing their badges and their name tags or whatever during such a heightened time of activity in the area. Was it so that they could do what they wanted to and no one would be able to identify them and or be able to file a formal complaint because we wouldn't have the badge number of the officer? Or is it that, you know, they were really doing things for their own level of safety? What I don't know, but listening to some of the things that officer had to say, wonders how he's an officer, because he's definitely not there to protect and serve all people. He has a certain idea about a specific race of people and who they are and what they're capable of doing. And so he comes into work every day with that mindset. So if that's what he believes and thinks and feels, how is he going to protect those whom he's there to serve, whose salary is paid by the very people who he deemed to be so unworthy of his level of support and protection because of who he is? So it's disheartening. It really is that we have people on the force that's sent to protect and serve us that view us in such low regard and have such negative perceptions about us. And yet, you know, you get to walk around with a gun all day and say what you want to say and treat people how you want to treat them, which if you look back at some of the accounts are from the Michael Brown shooting, is that the officer was cussing them and said, get your A out the street and get up on that effing sidewalk and, you know, all this type of stuff, you know. How do you go from that to, well, I know how you go from that to shooting because that's just what happened. So he should not be an officer. He should, once the suspension is over, they need to do a thorough investigation of him and any cases he's had before and the arrests he's made and everything he's done should be scrutinized at this point. Because who can trust him, you know? Who can trust this police officer that he's done things by law and not by his own philosophy? So he should be suspended. And they should have put their badges back on. I don't know who made that departmental decision. I mean, because we definitely don't know who was really in charge in Ferguson, because you had, you know, the Ferguson police was doing what they wanted to do, although the Justice Department had told them not to do things. The governor's office wasn't informed of decisions they were making. You bring in the Missouri Highway Patrol with Captain Ryan Johnson to do certain things, and he's not informed. So who made the departmental decision that y'all don't need to wear y'all badges and name tags? Who made that decision, and who thought that was okay? That person shouldn't be in their position either.
Yeah, it's bad. I mean, I think we have a national problem. You know, I'm sitting here looking at some footage. I'm sitting here looking at some footage of police officers, and you know, people often talk about the God complex that doctors have, mm-hmm. and it seems to me that that the police officers are now falling into that category with the God complex. Now, certainly, I don't believe that it's all of them. You know, like, certainly I don't believe that all African Americans are deviants and act that way, but they show our man getting us a bad rep, right? And so mm-hmm. those ones that are doing all of the horrible things that we're is being captured over and over again is really giving the police officers a bad rep. You know, and I'm sure, just like any other service position, people don't get in there so they can get a license to kill or a license to beat people. You know, they get in there because they really want to provide some service, and hopefully that's the case. You know, we're talking teachers, firemen, a clergy. You know, they get in because they really want to provide a service and, you know, do the right thing. And then when you have these people that continue to do bad things and be captured doing these bad things, it's certainly not good at all. You know, it's certainly
But here's the thing that often perplexes me, is that when it comes to black people, African Americans, people of color, specifically black people, we have the, and I'm saying this to be facetious, the luxury of being lumped in all together, right? So
that's true.
You know, we're lumped in as angry black people, the angry black man, the angry black woman. We're lumped in to the child that's disrespectful and the thief, the criminal, the thug. Let me just, the thug, because remember what they did to Richard Sherman. You know, he was a thug, and this guy is a college graduate from Stanford. But he was a thug because of how he responded to the interview. But yet, when you look at the number of mass shooting curves and the ones that have caused mass shooting, why are young white men not lumped into the same category as possible mass shooters?
Yeah.
I mean, the data is there to prove. I mean, I'm not making this up. I'm not being, you know, in some conspiracy theory mode. But what gives them the benefit of the doubt that other races don't get? Not other races, but black people don't get. We don't get the benefit of the doubt. They get the benefit of the doubt to be crazy or to have some mental health issues. Ours is what? That's just who we are.
Yeah.
So, you know, all that plays into this whole thing of how people are portrayed and how people's perceptions become how they operate in their reality. And because of that, then they get to excuse away their behavior because of what they've seen on television or what they've heard or what they've read.
So let's go to the phone lines. The number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. We're going to go to the caller, last 40240. Give us your name, where you're calling from, and do you have a comment or a question?
Yes. My name is Jacques. And anyway, as I have noticed, only about maybe 200 people demonstrated, or even less numbers. Am I right or wrong?
You're saying 200 demonstrated about the Ferguson case?
Yes, yes.
Well,
was it more?
I'm going to say across the nation, there were hundreds of thousands of people that demonstrated. In Ferguson specifically, there are a few hundred there assembled to protest.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. So I have this question. I mean, are they so scared from 200 people that they have to bring all this Iraqi armor and tanks and mini tanks and et cetera? I have a question for you.
That's a great point. You know, it goes back to the notion that I talked about earlier. It is perceptions of African Americans across the United States, and it's kind of bleeding over into the rest of the world. But, you know, people are afraid of certain things because they have been conditioned to be afraid of them. A lot of people are afraid of snakes because the snakes have been shown to kill people, to bite people, to poison them. The same thing with lions and tigers and aggressive animals. So if I begin to show you the aggression of African Americans through videos, through movies, through the rap industry, and I continue to show that, and if I don't know you, if I don't live next to an African American, then I believe that that person is aggressive, and I believe that they're angry, and I believe that they're mad, and I think that they're all rappers. And so they bring in these vehicles, this armored vehicles, and this Iraqi type, you know, IED type of vehicles because they believe
LRAD. LRAD, yeah. LRAD,
exactly.
Is that, and then it involves a special sound that you will automatically disperse because sound wave goes into your nervous system, and actually it should make you more agitated, and that's what happens to me, I think.
That's right. That's absolutely correct. And so this has been tried over and over again. I mean, this same activity was of aggression by the police officers was done in the 1960s, and they was used to put fire hoses, bring dogs. It does raise it's heightening awareness, and it does make you more angry or more agitated, and it puts you both on the defensive, right? So absolutely. So what do you think, Jerk, about the situation in Ferguson and the police officers and their treatment of African Americans across the country?
I say, actually, police doesn't treat anybody right. Let's put it that way. I mean, not only African-American or white. I mean, just white person killed yesterday in South Salt Lake City. If you go to Channel 2 News, Salt Lake City, you are able to see the headline right now there, you know. And then, as you see it very much, that, you know, white cop killed the white cop, and now they say they need justice over there. We see that in New York, that there are five people go ahead and, you know, this person hands up, he's harmless, you know, you can just use the taser. You don't need to attack this 300-400-pound, you know, in this case was a black person. You know, I have to use black. I don't want to use black, white. We are all brothers and sisters, in matter of fact, you know. I mean, regardless of what, you know, where we came from, etc. However, you know, I have to use that black and white, etc., unfortunately. But, you know, so we say that police doesn't treat anybody right.
You're right about that. So I'm not sure, you know, what part of the country you're from. You may be from the East Coast, West Coast, South, or the North. Certainly, I'm from the South, and I've seen a lot of activity in the United States, police activities, in a negative light against African Americans. So, what has been your experience, you know, across the nation or wherever you're from, with police?
But I mean, another thing that we have to understand, you know, if a police tell you, you know, for example, catch you while you're driving. Or as you put your hands on the wheels, you put little bit window down, and, you know, and you ask, hi, how are you, and etc. Is this everything ask you, you say yes or no, or, you know, yes, sir, no, sir, you know, respect police officer, too. We have to learn that. Unfortunately, we see many times, you know, we get agitated by the just pulling us over. Oh, why they pull me over? Why they pull me over? And sometimes we run away from the police. And then that will cause for them really to bring 50, 60 cops, you know, all the way behind you. And then get you maybe 100 miles down the road or maybe 20 miles down the road. But they will get you, finally. But, yes, you know, instead of, we have to train our people, respect police regardless. Am I right or wrong? I mean, generally speaking.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And you know, what's interesting, I think that respect should go both ways, right? I mean, I think it's the right... people should respect the individual rights, right? I think in the Ferguson case, at least it was being reported by some of the witnesses that, you know, the police pulled up on these two young men walking in the street, and he, you know, he said some explicitives to them. He cursed at them, basically. He said, get your A out of the street. And so that is also not good behavior if a police officer is doing that, right? That is not something, you know, again, you're talking about bringing the large vehicles in. That is also a way to agitate a person, right? You should be – respect should go both ways, right? Now, certainly, you know, as the civilian, you should be respectful of authority. You should be doing the right thing. You should be making no sudden moves. And I think most African Americans that I know are taught that when they're very, very young because of the history of police killing blacks. So we already go in knowing that we have to have a defensive posture. And I guarantee if you were to ask the majority of young black men today around 16 years or older, they know the routine. The routine is you say yes, sir, you say no, sir. But the problem, I think, arises when you start cussing at them and you start pushing them and start trying to bully them, then I think anybody would respond, you know, in an appropriate manner.
Exactly. Very good points. We have to, from the population-wise, we have to, whether you're white, whether you're yellow, whether you're black, whether you're red, etc. I mean, you have to learn how to talk to the police or higher authority. If the higher authority say stop, you put your hands up, put it against your back, you say, yes, sir, I am in, means I'm surrendered. Okay, what would you like me to do next, sir? You know, you do that. Okay, is it okay I turn around? Yes, no. Okay, what do you want me to do? You want me to lay down? Okay, I lay down. You know, something like that. You know, you don't agitate. Let them, okay. They mistaken identity you with somebody, you know, in this case, Salt Lake City, it was last night, or last 36 hours. You know, it was 7-Eleven, somebody came and took money and et cetera. And when police arrived, you know, they took two people into the car. They told them to get out and et cetera. And I guess the way the video shows, the white cops, you know, killed this white person in the cold manner. I mean, he just put a bullet into him because he reached into his belly to his belt, tight his belt or something. They thought maybe he's the one who has the gun. Assumption, you know, but they assume a lot, you know, from
they assume too much. They assume too much. You're right.
Yeah, they too much assume that, you know, the person who got is the same guy that who robbed 7-Eleven. So let them get $200. Big deal. 7-Eleven is insured. You know, big deal about it. I mean, right. You're not going to kill somebody for $200 or et cetera. Big deal. You know, or I mean, you can later on, you have a videos, you can see the pictures and et cetera, put it on the data police, and you will know who is that, and you can go after him later on. I mean, assumption of police that these white people, brothers, I mean, they were, one of them was an armed robber, and which he was armless, and indeed, in the cold blood, was killed. So it's a white, it seems white police is against white. White is against black. Even black police is against white, or black, or vice versa, it can be. But the question is, again, they assume a lot, and we also, it was his fault. That put his hand into his belly. When police say, put your hands up, sit down, how come they didn't shoot the other guy? Because the other guy followed the police command. And the other one said, well, I'm in this position, let me tie my belt, for example, and police, boom, 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 shoot him like 7-8 times.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly agree with you. I mean, we certainly have to be cognizant of our behavior when we engage with figures of authority, right? That is certainly something that we should all understand, because the police, you know, they're fear for their lives, right? They're already called, you know, and certainly in a position. They think of weakness because of the fact that they call into an incident and they need to be prepared and have the mindset, and they don't want to go home shot up and everything. So I certainly understand that. I certainly understand that,
right.
You know, as a citizen, we have to be really aware of our situation and not be agitated. But they certainly come into contact a lot with people, and they should be able to handle those situations a lot better than just taking out your gun and shooting someone. It seems to be that should
exactly.
be
it. I mean,
a progression.
Right. Shooting should be the last resort.
Exactly.
And yet, this person is right there. I mean, where can he go? You guys are just 100 centimeters or less than 2 feet away from there. So where
right,
they
right.
can go? You have all the police around the block. You know, where they can go or where he can go. I mean, even if he has a gun. what he can do. Is he going to start shooting and what? I mean, he has no way. As soon as you see something, I mean, you guys are going to look like the guy in New York who was shot at 50 times.
Yeah, that was excessive.
Do you remember it?
Yeah.
That was a long time ago. It was like 10 years ago or 20 years ago or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember?
Yeah, absolutely. We talked about it last week on the show. Absolutely.
So they should teach them, instead of shoot to kill, they say, no, shoot to disable, or shooting should be last option. But it seems right now they have the option right away. If you a little bit run away, okay, maybe, you know, you're scared. Sometimes you have, you are in the stress position, stress. It tells you fight or flight.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, in that position, you know, people may be upset or they want to run away a little bit, but they cannot run away anyway. So let them run. Okay.
Yeah.
You will catch them the next block.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and then you will see if they have a gun or they have no gun. I mean, what kind of thing. I mean, we see that all the time. They have helicopters, drones, and et cetera. So let them for the sake of, you know, God and everybody, let them go a few times to see what happens. Is it, I mean, maybe more stress for them to catch the guy later on, but it's not much stress than the shooting. I think it would be less stressful for them to catch the guy alive and prosecute it. And, you know, if he's not guilty, they free him next day, say, I'm sorry, we caught you. You are not the right person who, in this case, 7-Eleven store at South Salt Lake City. So we can see, you know, it's just police keep making mistakes, and people are fed up.
Yeah, and it also puts policing, the entire concept of policing, in a very awkward situation, right? Because you know, the police officers in their psyche, they're going to be hesitant to whether or not to pull the trigger, you know. And so in some instances, they should be able to do that, right? They should have that freedom to do that. But it certainly should not be something that they do every single time they come up on a call. The first thing they do is just take out their weapons. But they're going to be putting themselves in position to be retrained, to revisit how they're, you know. And then certainly we could also certainly end up with a lot of dead police officers because of that. Because they may have to second guess themselves now because of the heightened sense of awareness of all of the because of all of the shootings.
Yes, I remember it was a while back ago, you know, sometimes ago, where I used to live, there was cops all the time coming and etc. You know, it was one of my neighbors, you know, and so finally, you know, I always, when I see something, I go out, you know, to see what's going on, you know. And I see that this lady was so agitated and saying bad, very bad things to the cop. But at that time, it was like 10, 20 years back, you know, cops, it's okay. We are not going to do anything to you. You are right now, you know, you are saying bad things. It's okay. But and right now, we are in a different time difference than 20 years ago.
Yeah,
so you cannot say right now, if you say the same thing, police, you know, will be, you know, do anything they can. And so they're the boss when they come. Let's put it that way. But, you know, if, you know, something like this happens, you have to be nice. Say, okay, I will turn down my music or I turn down my speech or whatever you are doing at that time, you know, so I do apologize. You know, which one is better? Saying bad words? I mean, I saw that every day, and I used to put myself sometimes, negotiate with the police, etc. at that time. But no, I cannot do anything right now. Right now, if something happens, it's not my business right now. My own business right now. You know, you cannot go say,
exactly.
You know. About 20 years ago, you could. I just negotiated with Polish, this is old woman, you know, 80 years old, you know, she's on a lot of medications, and she has, you know, a lot of these problems, so, you know, just forgive her, you know, just tell her, bring it down, let her go. I mean, they go to his room, and I sit, and I videotape it too, and they come out, I shake hands with Polis, I say, you know, it's okay, you know, we know her, who she is, etc. But, you know, the question is, at this time, there's no such a thing. You can, if something happens, hey, it's not my business, I mean, it's not my business to intervene or negotiate or something anymore, because my life now is in danger. Matter of fact, you know, you see what I'm saying? So times have changed. We have to go with the flow, you know, and respect police and, you know, listen to the police. Whatever I say, don't, even a stress situation, don't try to tighten your belt. At that time, is a foolish thing to do. They think that is a gun. This is the guy that who robbed the 7-Eleven and stuff. They don't know that guy is already gone away a long time ago. They came late. You know, these are the new people. You know, they went, they were just around, you know, a 7-Eleven store at South Salt Lake City. You know, so...
Absolutely. Well, Doug, I really certainly thank you for your call. We're going to go on to our next segment right now. Again, stay on the line. We got a lot more to come. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Be back in a moment.
Cook Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our company, TaylorMade Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Gina can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for discounted books for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
It's time for Black Acre Policy Forum, a progressive think tank founded by Leo Baron Hicks, a place where a new dialogue concerning public policy can find innovative strategies and bold solutions. Welcome to Black Acre Policy Forum.
I'm able to see clear the right, cause Louis A. Slattimore improved the light, and J.A. Burr invented the lawnmower. Let me expand the mind of all you young soldiers. Sarah Boone invented the...
Social Death and the Process of Otherification was the blog we talked about last week. This week, we're going to talk about the ugly truth. The ugly truth, the Black Acre Policy blog. The death of Michael Brown and the Ferguson situation, while tragic, is nothing new. We have seen this before. We have done this before. We have been here before. Jim Crow brought us the Wilmington Riot of 1878, the Atlanta Riot and the Brownsville Affair of 1906, the Waco Horror of 1916, the Red Summer, and the Elaine, Arkansas Riot of 1919. The Tulsa Riot of 1921, and the Scottsboro Boys of 1931. We have lived through Rodney King, experienced Trayvon Martin and Jordan Davis, and witnessed the Gen of Six. The latest outrage is merely deja vu all over again. There is, however, an important distinction between then and now. It is a distinction that is not easily discussed but must be addressed. That difference is the ugly truth of culpability. In the not-too-distant past, we have been uneducated, but we're hardly stupid. We knew right from wrong and the value of good education. We were possessed of a spiritual prosperity wherein our homes, our possession, and our culture were treasures, not to be lost, stolen, or discarded. We might have been poor, but we value what we had. And our wealth was measured not in money, but in our history of perseverance, love of family, and dedication to community. More importantly, we did nothing to worsen our situation. We did not invite trouble and took no action to aid and abet our oppressors. We watched what we said and how we acted, especially in public. We did not harm one another and avoided criminal behavior. Hence, the hatred and violence we experienced sprang from without rather than within. And while often denied, we always tried. In summary, we were hardly perfect, yet we were essentially good. The now is different. To be sure, we are doing much that is right, but we are also doing much which is wrong. Whatever the circumstances surrounding the Michael Brown affair, the facts of which are murky, as deplorable as the criminal justice system, and deplorable it is, as many innocent and not so innocent lives it has taken, and it does so repeatedly and without consequence, we are the enemy at the gate. It is this ugly truth of which we should be concerned. For example, prior to the Brown killing, how many Ferguson blacks have executed the brothers and sisters? How many blacks from other American communities are equally guilty of this sin? And where is the moral outrage, the marches, the protests concerning these murders? This is not to say that the targeting of a young black males by the criminal justice system does not occur. It most certainly does. If the officer in Ferguson, Missouri, unfairly or illegally took a life, if he violated his oath of office, no matter how slight, then he should be punished to the fullest extent of the law. However, as there is no excuse for the summary of execution of blacks by the police, there is also no excuse for the abridgment of blacks by other blacks. And if the pattern of fratricide persists, as it undoubtedly will, how much blood will drip from ebony hands? The looting and the violence which has accompanied the Ferguson incident are utterly unacceptable. So too is the rationalization thereof. These are African Americans who do not take the fight for justice to the perceived enemy. They instead destroy their own community. As the militarization of the Ferguson police is not a good look, neither are the images of black lawlessness. The theft, criminal damage to property, and rioting only serves to obscure and subtract from the predicate injustice. In the end, it is the lawlessness that will be remembered, not the loss of Michael Brown. We cannot forget the marches, protests, and speeches that occasioned the Genesis 6 controversy, and nothing changed. We distinctly remember the demands for justice regarding Trayvon and Jordan, and nothing changed. We recall the regrets, the riots, death, and destruction that accompanied the Rodney King verdict, and nothing changed. And despite this latest angst, regardless the current sound and fury, and well after the newest tempest has waned, here too nothing will change, except that the community of Ferguson will be a little poorer and significantly more desolate. From a public policy position, this is the last thing we need. These incidents keep happening for a reason. There is an important lesson to be learned. That lesson is simply this. As people, we simply must do better. We cannot be satisfied with just getting by. We cannot invite trouble and then complain when it arrives. We can neither tolerate nor sanction the criminal element within our community and no longer excuse the inexcusable. And we will not be respected until and unless we first respect ourselves. Many will take exception to these comments. Some will conclude that we are being too hard on family. We make no pretense at divinity, admit to no monopoly on the truth, and understand all too well the constant struggle of everyday survival. But we care deeply about the plight of our people, African Americans in particular. Throughout the ages, too many have sacrificed too much to ensure our survival. We would not squander these sacrifices by being less than those upon whose shoulders we stand. We have greatness within us. But the path of irresponsibility and self-loathing we currently tread will be our undoing. The real problem is that blacks respect blacks far less than those who oppose us. And the ugly truth is that when it comes to the abuse of African Americans, our hands are anything. I introduce the some and present the others. No other than Leo Baron Hicks.
How you doing, my brother?
Leo, welcome to the show.
Hey, man, thanks so much, man. It's always nice to be on your show. I appreciate you so much.
You know, it is the pleasure is mine. You know, in fact, and I encourage all the listening audience right now to go out to blackacrepolicyblog.org. That's B-L-A-C-K. A as in Alpha, C as in Charlie, R as in Romeo, E as in Echo, Black Acre Policy Forum, F-O-R-U-M.org. All one word, blackacrepolicyforum.org, and take a look at this blog. I mean, there's two great ones out there, one of which I read, The Ugly Truth, which we're going to talk about here momentarily, but the other is to give credit where credit is due. And last week, I mean, the otherification is a classic. So I encourage people to go out there and take a look at those blogs. If you're listening to the show right now, listening to it later, go out there and leave your comments and certainly call into the show and speak to the author. He is certainly someone that you certainly want to get a hold of. So, Leo, let's talk about today's blog, The Ugly Truth. I mean, it was hard to hear, but it's certainly something we need to hear. So what inspired you to write this?
I just think that we have some work to do. I think that we fundamentally need to clean up our act. I think we need to get busy. And I, for one, am tired of the same old scenario that keeps playing over and over and over again, like Groundhog Day, where something horrible happens to a black person, and we march and we protest and we speak and we demand justice, but at the end of the day, not a damn thing changes. And then we move to the next outrage, and we repeat that pattern over and over and over again. And I'd like to see us move forward rather than move backwards.
Interesting. Gene, what do you think about this Groundhog Day that we found ourselves in again?
Well, this is difficult because I hear the perspective and I understand it and I respect it, but, you know, I'm not going to lump all of that in the same basket. I think when you say we ought to do something different, then what is it? I mean, if things are going to change, we have to come up with a strategy to make that happen. And so out of this, you know, one of the things that some of the community leaders down there was talking about in Ferguson was the lack of voter turnout, and how in this just last election that they had last year, of the 20,000 people that live in the city and registered, only 1,200, 1,300 went out to vote. Well, therein is a problem. So if you want to have an impact on the system that is making the rules and laws that you have to abide by, then you have to participate in the process. So I get that. I do. There was those on the ground that was registering people to vote and talking about the importance of voting and how you want more a different mayor or a different police chief. You know, those people are appointed. Some are elected. And you need to be part of that process. If you want some different people on your school board, you need to show up at a school board meeting. So you'll know what's happening and who those people are that are making these decisions for your child's education. So I agree that there has to be some accountability in terms of how you want things to go, But on the same token, and this is just my stand on top of the hill and shout, I don't think it's either or, it's both and. We still have to do that. We still have to do the rally. You know, somebody still has to rally the people to make it be an issue, because if nobody makes it be an issue, then there's nothing going to happen. There won't be a voter registration drive the next time. I mean, so it's not an either or. I think it's a both and. And so although it feels as though, here we go again, you know, what changed in Stanford? Well, nothing's changed down there yet. But I guarantee you, you get rid of that governor down there, you might have some different things happening in Florida than what you have right now. But to get rid of the governor, you got to get the people registered to vote. You got to challenge that voting rights law that they enacted down there. So you got to do some other steps before you can get stand your ground off the books. So it won't. It's not tomorrow we go and march and rally and we have protest signs and we boycott, and then the next day something happens. It doesn't work that way. I often talk about what happened with the Montgomery Boys boycott. They boycotted and walked for over a year before something happened. They didn't just stop walking for a day or a month, you know, or 6 months. They saw every season before something changed. And something changed because the bottom line of their dollars changed. And so we've got to figure out the right strategy. And because we have all this technology now, we've overcome, and everybody has their own little world and their island, if we find it difficult to agree on even what we want to protest, what we want to boycott, we can't even agree on that. So when something happens, you know, we have a reaction to it, because for some of us, it's giving us a purpose and a focus. And then for some of us, it's like, okay, here we go again, and what's going to change? Nothing's going to change. So they don't even participate. They just sit on the sidelines and talk about what's not going to happen. But what are you doing to help the process? And so I think, you know, I agree, you know, with the perspective in terms of where, you know, Leo is going. But I think it's just not either or. It's a both and. We have to hold each other accountable, hold ourselves accountable, and then what are we, you know, how are we going to move it forward? And what is the plan?
Yeah. So Leo, Groundhog Day, there I mean, there's a lot in that statement. There are certainly some that would agree with this notion, because you've certainly given several accounts of activities that has taken place in the past, and there's been no change. But when you talk about this notion of voting and getting people to register, it certainly has an impact on the legislators. It certainly has an impact on who's on the jury. It certainly has an impact on the local policies that are affected in a local community. So what do you think of this notion of one step moving the ball forward to impact change is getting people to vote?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there is no question about it. Voting is crucial. And my only point was, quite frankly, is that just raising a lot of hell in and of itself may make us feel good, but it doesn't produce the positive consequences that we really need. And I guess the second point I wanted to make is that to a large extent, we are inviting problems upon ourselves. When we disobey the law, that's a problem. And I just don't think African Americans should tolerate the type of criminality that occurs all too often in our own community. Everybody in a poor community knows, for example, exactly where the drug house is. They know precisely where the drug house is. They know who's breaking into all of the homes and everything else. They know who the gangbangers are. And for some reason, you know, we have this non-snitch mentality where we think that we aren't supposed to stop that, when I think we should. And one of the things that Jima brought up is that during the civil rights movement, there certainly were marches and protests, but there was also lawful behavior, and there was also brand control. We had the moral high ground in that situation because we did what was right, because we looked good, because we fought for justice, and we did it in such a way that it didn't diminish from our cause. But if you take the Ferguson, Missouri situation, to riot, to break into stores and steal TVs have just the opposite effect. And we have to be very careful about brand control, and we have to be very careful about maintaining the moral high ground.
Which goes back to the point of who were, and you know, we talked about this last week as well in terms of the agitators, and you know, who were these people that came into town, because a lot of the people that were being arrested wasn't even from Ferguson. So who was these agitators that was coming in to be disruptive to what the family of the slain young man said wanted to be peaceful? So who were these people? And so you parcel out and deal with them. But you go back to that time in history where there was a certain amount of respect for authority. There was a certain amount of respect for your elders. Well, you have people now who not only don't respect themselves, they don't respect nobody else. And so if you get up at the bullhorn and you're making a statement, you could get called all sorts of names from the people in the crowd that are, you know, maybe 30 or 40 years younger than you, because they have no sense of respect. And so how do we can't even put ourselves in the same vein as how they accomplished so much back then, because we've lost so much respect for ourselves, we don't even see that what we're doing is out of order. I totally agree with you, Leo. I totally agree that when we have the rioting and the looting and all the stuff, that it takes away from the point that we're trying to make. And so how do you get those people who are not helping but more so hindering out of the way, and that they don't get, because see, they end up taking over the coverage, because now it was a night of looting. That's what led all the news conferences and all the broadcasts was looting. And then, you know, then you bring in the tanks and you bring in the trucks and you bring in all that stuff, which made it be all the more crazy. You know, and it wasn't but a fraction of people that did it, but it's always a small fraction that starts the fire. It's always something like that. So how do we, you know, it's difficult to even manage that, the agitators that sometimes are brought in, sometimes are paid to do just that, agitate and distract. And we should be ready for that, so that when it happens, we know how to handle it. And I think what took Ferguson off guard, the people there, the people on the ground, was that they wasn't expecting the agitators, the outsiders, to come in and do that. And because of that, they didn't have a plan.
You know, I want to talk about two things that Leo mentioned. One, lawful behavior. Two, brand control. Mm-hmm. You know, what's interesting is that last week we had a caller that called in and talked about the young people should be, you know, taking over and stepping in the foreground, and while the older people should be stepping in the background. And my position was that it should be a transition. And one of the transitions I want to talk about is certainly what worked back in the 60s was this notion of civil disobedience with nonviolent behavior, and we certainly did have brand control. But Leah, I don't see the transition being made from the elders to the younger generation, or at least certainly the younger generation are not listening to the older generation with this whole peaceful notion of civil disobedience. And certainly brand control. I'm gonna maintain my position with respect to the media and what they choose to portray about an event. Now, granted, the looting became the lead story of the activity because of that event, and we certainly had a lot to do with that. But if you do buy into this idea that Jima talked about of these agitators, then these agitators can come into any situation and consume the news cycle, and you kind of miss all of the facts that's going on behind the scenes, i.e. the cop didn't make a written report. You know, did anybody do a toxicology, a tox makeup of the shooter? Where were the eyewitnesses? Where was his statement? They didn't get both sides of the story, because what led the news was the looting. You know, and we don't know with a high degree of certainty whether or not there were agitators, you know, that it consumed the news cycle. So this notion of civil disobedience or lawful behavior, when we're talking about, standing up when these activities, because they're going to happen again, right? We already talked about they happening before nothing changed. So that means I can assume that they're going to happen in the future. But there needs to be a transition about how to, to really hold your position peacefully, that to really understand what civil disobedience is about, get those lessons learned from the 60s and have that transition from the elders over to the younger generations to be prepared for this situation. And certainly, when we talk about the controlling our branding or controlling our the narrative, if you will, is the language I like to use, is that we certainly need to be out there in front of this issue and, be able to dispel any negative notions that may be portrayed of African Americans. So Leo, my question is for you, lawful behavior, how do you get that if we don't have a transition from the elders to the younger generations when the younger generations don't want to listen?
Well, I mean, I'm telling you, man, it's tough. And far be it from me to pretend like I have all the answers, because I don't. Let me, though, make this suggestion. Maybe what we really need to do is start very early with our kids at 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 years old and take a long-range strategy and take years, if not decades, inculcating within them the positive attitudes and respect and responsibility that we want our kids to have, knowing that you won't see the fruit of that effort until years down the road, because I am not convinced, quite frankly, that we would be very successful if we tried to get the 18, 19, and 20 years old who've already adopted the thugocracy and the pimpology that infest our communities. You know, we can try that strategy, but I'm not quite sure of the return on the investment. So I guess my position on that transition is to plant the seeds of that type of lawful, positive behavior in kids as young as 2 and 3 and 5 and 6 years old and count on reaping the harvest of that effort later on down the road.
You know, I certainly, you and I, we discussed this in the past, and I certainly agree with that notion. Jimmy, what do you think about that? The fact that, and I'm not going to say this. I don't want to say this in a disheartening way, but, maybe we have a lost generation, and let's chalk it up as that, and certainly reach our hands up, but those that don't reach back, we really don't spend a whole lot of time. We really take the time, effort, money, resources, and start focusing on the next generation in preparation for this to happen 5 and 10 years down the road. Because we have a history, a legacy of these happening, every generation. So why not let's get the younger generation prepared? What do you think about that?
Well, I agree, and I think. The therapist in me won't just say we're gonna give up on them, but I'm gonna give you what you need to be successful. I am gonna reach back. Now, if you don't grab my hand, that's not on me. So I can go on to the next one at that point. But we've got to make sure that we're doing our part on the front end of that, and that is the reaching back. That it what and however that looks for you, for some that's starting as some sort of nonprofit and doing some after-school programming at a local school that you know has a failing grade where kids are not passing the standardized test. So what can you go into that school to do to help them prepare? You know, that's reaching back. It doesn't have to be something major. You know, getting with that local school board and figuring out, or that local PTA and figuring out what you can do in that school, in that neighborhood to make an impact right there. It doesn't always have to be some grandiose idea or on some grandiose scale that you're going to impact, everybody all at once, because each one teach one, and if you get one out of that 50, you've done well. And so I think reaching back and then making sure that's what we're doing, and then the ones that grab hold, let's make sure we have something to give them to hold on to. And the ones that don't, we know where they're going to end up at. And eventually our paths will cross again, because we'll see them somewhere. you know, that they'll be part of whatever a prison ministry or children of incarcerated parents ministry that you'll be trying to do to help give back and help prepare. So we'll run across them again. They just might not be ready to receive it. So I'm gonna go on to the next one who is ready. And that's what we should find ourselves doing.
Leo, I want to also mention, you know, this thought, and that is some of our 18, 19-year-olds are having babies at 16, 17 years old, and they are starting to raise our 1 and 2 years old with the same level of attitudes and behaviors as they are growing up with. So we don't, you know, make some effort to get to those 18, 19 years old that are raising these 2 and 3 years old, seems like we're going to have another cycle. What do you think about
that? I agree. No, I agree wholeheartedly with you, but my approach is the 80-20 rule. 80% of our resources should be going towards the 2 and 3 year olds from a prevention strategy to prevent them from catching the fool, Negro, dog, B-I-T-C-H mentality, as opposed to devoting the majority of our resources towards curing the 18, 19, and 20-year-olds who've already got the fool, Negro, dog, B-I-T-C-H mentality. I think an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And while I am loathe to disagree with anything Jima says, if we're only reaching 1 out of 50, that is a losing proposition. That return on our investment will not sustain our people. We've got to get a much higher return on our investment than that.
Well, I agree with that, but I'm not going to not do anything just because I don't know if I'm going to get 25 out of 50. I got to start somewhere, and if I get one, then that's good. I mean, I'm gonna keep trying. I'm not going to be happy with one, but I see that the one that I did catch before they hit the bottom, that's one less that somebody else doesn't have to deal with. And then I continue to go. It's not a one and I'm done. I mean, my ultimate goal is to reach all 50. But, you know, I also know the obstacles that I'm dealing with and the circumstances and the barriers that are going to be there. So depending on the person that's trying to knock the barriers down, you getting 5 out of 50 for you might be great. Somebody else might could get 25 first time out the gate. But if we're not even trying to get one and we're just talking about it and passing through it and walking over it and come and having all these wonderful discussions about it, but we're not doing anything, then, you know, what's the point?
Well, I understand your position. Well, I understand your position. I mean, I really do, and I respect your position. But this is a fundamental debate that is occurring within African American society right now. And my position is not that we should do nothing for the 18 and 19 and 20 years olds. I'm just saying that the vast majority of our resources should be directed at the 2 and 3 year olds to make sure they don't adopt a negative mindset in the first place. And 20%, and you can change those percentage. Maybe the right percentage is 70-30. Maybe it's even 65-35. Maybe it's even 60-40. But I'll tell you, I have seen a lot of work and effort go into those who've already adopted the gangster culture, and the return on the investment is not great, quite frankly. It's not great at all. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't try, but it does mean, quite frankly, that we should try new approaches and new strategies, because I see things getting worse, not better.
You know, Lee, I wonder with the fact that there's a lot of research that has gone into early childhood education, the amount of dollars that if you spend before a child turns 4 years old, and the less you will spend when he turns 14 or 24. the fact that legislators have been intimately involved in the results of these studies, but also have been reluctant to fund such causes. So when we look at an approach, how do you propose that we fund such of those opportunities when the majority of African Americans that are in positions or at least have the children that we really need to concentrate on, they don't have the resources to support?
Well, there is one institutional African American institution, quite frankly, that does have those resources, and that is the church. The church has any number of monetary resources. It has buildings. It has people. It has the wherewithal, quite frankly, to really make a material difference in who we are and where we're going. And I know this might be a slight change from the topic, but one of the things that gets me about the Ferguson situation is I'm from East St. Louis, Illinois, which is right across the river from Ferguson, and I can tell you there is a whole lot of black deaths in Ferguson that are caused by other black people. And if you do a comparison of the black people killed by police versus the black people killed by other black people, it is a depressing percentage in the wrong direction.
You know, what's interesting is that I think one thing I want to say about the church is that I think it's a misconception that the church has resources that enable them to provide that type of service to the community. You know, I've been in a couple of different states over the last decade, and there have been several churches that I've attended, quite frankly, have trouble keeping their books. And when I say that, I'm talking about the contributions that the members make. When you juxtapose that to the outlays that go out of the church, on you know, 80 to 90% of the time, the church ends up in a deficit because of the amount of resources that they have in trying to just maintain everyday living of the church. And so then you juxtapose that with, you know, the amount of resources it takes to run a program, and then the amount of people, qualified people that it takes to actually do that. It is a tough position for the church to be in. And so, you know, while I hear that it is certainly an avenue, I'm not sure that the church has the means that it used to have back in 20, 30 years ago, because the actual numbers are down by in attendance, as well as the giving is down, and the credibility, quite frankly, is down. So, I mean, you know, I don't know. I mean, it sounds to me that, you know, I certainly think that's one approach, but I'm not sure if it has the infrastructure anymore to provide those services.
You know, Mr. Cook, you probably know a whole lot more about the resources of the church than I do. And so if that's your opinion, it's an opinion I respect.
What do you think, Jim?
Well, I think it's a combination. Yes, I think the church could do more, but I agree that on some scale, a lot of churches do not have a lot of the financial means to do some things. They could open their doors more than Sunday and Wednesday. I agree with that. They could be available in their communities. They could really, when they talk about adopting a school in their neighborhood, if they're in a neighborhood, because some of them are so far out that they're not even attached to anything but their church. So if they're a part of a church that's part of a community, then they can find some local agency there in the community, or a local elementary school or middle school or whatever, to find out what the needs are in that school. And all the needs are not financial. Some needs are they need extra people to come read to the kids, because if you're in an area where a lot of parents go to work, they don't have the opportunity or the ability to go and volunteer at the school and be there to read to kids that are having trouble reading, or to help tutor kids in certain areas. And so if you have that time and that availability in that area, in that community, then that's a way you can give back. So yeah, the church could do more, and I think it has to be a little bit more creative. in what they do and not always think it's going to cost them some money to do it. It might cost you your time, and I know for some of us that's valuable, but think of the lives that you'll be impacting that way. So there's more than one way to give back from the church's perspective, but you can't get the church to do what it needs to do in-house. So it's difficult to expect it to go out and do something outside. So that's a whole nother conversation. But I hear you, Patrick, but I get where Leo's point is too. You know, they are the one organization that has been a mainstay in the fabric of America and the fabric of our culture. And so we know that a lot of what happened in the past came out of the church, out of the basements of the church where the meetings were secretly being held. And so with things, you know, the Montgomery Voice boycott happened in the basement of the church. They voted on it in the church about what they were going to do. So we know the church has a vital part to play. The problem is we have gotten away from the basic teachings of what Christ has instructed us to do, and we've come up with all these other things that we're not focused on what real Christianity is about and being Christ-like is about. So we can't even get to the other stuff because we've now weighed ourselves down with all this worldly stuff that we're missing what he has already charged us to do.
You know, we've talked about the church and the role of the church over the past several weeks, and, you know, I think it's time to find out. I think it's time that, you know, somebody took one step forward and asked the church to take care of a community and lay out a plan or show a plan to do that, if the church is going to be charged with that responsibility. And if it's not charged with that responsibility, then find out what that church is responsible for. I mean, I understand it is about saving souls, and I don't want to get that lost, but there certainly has to be some additional responsibility of the church, and it's time to find out what they are. Because I think this speculation, at least on my part, about what the church's role is, I need to get a little bit a better understanding of what the church role is and then what their involvement, and more importantly, what their strategy or plan is to do something about it. Because we certainly have a lot going on in our community that certainly needs to be addressed. And so, Leah, I think that if that is the statement that you've made, I'm going to find out where or how much validity to that statement is over the next week. And I will be making reports on my findings on not just one church, but multiple churches, in at least in close proximity to me. And I want to know. Because we certainly, Ferguson is not an isolated incident. I mean, I think these activities are happening all across our nation. And it's certainly time to find out. If the church is going to be responsible for doing it, I think it's time to find out. Leo, final thoughts. Go ahead.
You know, Mr. Cook, that's an excellent idea, quite frankly. You know, going straight up and talking to these churches and asking them, will you take responsibility for this community? Yes or no? I think that is an excellent strategy that you and Jima have come up with. Let me also maybe suggest another institution that can really do some good, and that is the HBCUs. To take the learning out of the classroom and ask the HBCUs the same thing that you want to ask the church. Will you take responsibility for making a positive difference in this community?
Absolutely. And what I'm going to do, I'm going to actually list out, up to maybe about 100, because I think, quite frankly, there's probably about four or five churches in any particular community. And so, go to a map, look at the high concentration of issues, and then draw a circle, maybe a 100, a 20-mile radius around that particular area, and then find the churches in that community and ask them what they're doing. And then get a real concrete list of activities, and let's start taking a look at what the results are of their activities. You know, those in HBCUs absolutely will start doing that. Leo, final thoughts.
I don't have any. I just want to thank you. And I guess perhaps I do have a final thought, and that's this. Black Acre really struggles with trying to reach the proper balance between recognizing the obstacles that we face versus some sense of personal responsibility to make our situation better. And I'm not quite sure we found the balance yet, but we're working on it.
You know, I think it's certainly, and it's something my mom taught me, is that to make sure before I start going out and talking to anybody else about what's going on in the neighborhood that I take care of my home first. And so my understanding, at least where I see up to this point, what Black Acre is doing, it says, get your house squared away. And once you get your house squared away, then we can go out and then we can start, you know, looking at these other issues. But we have to take one step in one direction. Why not do something we have complete control over? Because, as you mentioned before, we don't have control over the media, at least at this point. We don't have complete control over what activities that, you know, for the criminal justice is, but we do have complete control over whether or not we can commit a crime. We don't have complete control on how our sisters are acting out in public, but we do have complete control on how we treat them. So there is a lot of things that we can do, and I certainly appreciate you at least raising the questions, pointing out the issues, and says, hey, and keeping the issues highlighted. It says, hey, there's a lot of work we have yet to be done. So, yeah, quite naturally, all those things are happening. We recognize them, and they should not be occurring. But we have a lot that we can do ourselves, and I certainly appreciate you keeping that message alive because I think we all need to hear it.
Well, thanks, but it's not a necessarily easy road to travel, quite frankly.
I definitely it's not. Keep up the good work, man. Keep up or keep up the good work.
I wish it wasn't me, but
Leo Barry.
If not you, then who? Now,
I will tell you this. One of the reasons I do it is because I can do it, and if I can do it, that means mm-hmm. I'm obligated to do it.
That's right. That's right. Yep.
Leo Barron Hicks, everybody. Leo Barron Hicks, our man. All right, Jim. I want to. We're wrapping up here. I wanted to get to the Ebola story, and because there was a couple of things that happened. All right, there has been an increased amount, about 800 Ebola deaths this year, and in no time was a drug treatment for the disease offered to any African or African patients. But yet we find that Nancy Wrightbo and Dr. Kent Brantley were cured. It looks like that they were actually cured of the disease and has no trace of Ebola in their system. So I want to kind of get to some of the comments that I've heard on the web about whether or not, and there's an article out there that Dr. Boyce Watkins that talked about and saying that is the Ebola cure for only for white people. Now, I don't want to entertain that type of rhetoric, but I certainly understand the question that was posed, and it primarily because of the fact that the Tuskegee experiment, and for those that don't know, the Center for Disease Control officially calls it the Tuskegee study of untreated syphilis in the Negro male, of involved 600 black men, 399 with syphilis, 201 that did not have it, but in short, they performed this experiment on these African Americans. So I certainly know there's a history of information being withheld, and there's experiments that have taken place in the United States about disease. So I wonder then, when you see this, could the real issue be what is the real issue with them not releasing such a virus to Africans?
Well, I think it was still – I could be wrong, but I thought it had something to do with it was still in its research phases, and they wasn't quite sure about whether or not it would meet the strand, because I think there's different strands of Ebola. And so I think they wasn't sure if the product they have was even going to work even on those people. And so now that they know, now the issue becomes funding to be able to mass produce it. And who's going to take that challenge on? So I don't think it was any sort of conspiratory moment to not treat people. I just don't think they thought it would work on that particular strand, and why they haven't tried it before. And maybe they have and we don't know. Maybe they tried it on someone and it didn't work. I mean, so I don't know. I'm not going to. I'm not going to over-theorize on this one, or over-intellectualize it, or even over-be emotional about it, because it's just, you know, I can't see them, you know, letting, you know, so many thousands of people die and they actually had a cure for it. I can't buy into that one.
Okay, some of the posted comments to the article have some real interesting theories, and I agree that it may be a little far-fetched, you know, but certainly when you look at the history and see the results, it does give one a cause for pause. And so I wanted to bring that up. However, I wonder, though, could the real issue be something as simple as saturating the community with guns as opposed to wiping out blacks, as opposed to trying to do it through a virus? And so I think we'll talk about that later. But, you know, we are quick to look at, you know, these conspiracy theories with respect to diseases and other comments. But when we have something as simple as guns that are killing people every day, I wonder, is that an issue that's more real than the Ebola virus? But anyway, let's get your final thoughts and wrap it up for today.
Well, I mean, you know, another great show. We had a lot going on. In case you wasn't aware, the Jackie Robinson baseball team out of South Side of Chicago came up a little short. They did a big rally in the sixth inning, but they lost 8-4 to South Korea. But it was a great game, a great just overall performance by that team that wasn't even supposed to be there. So our hats off and congratulations to the city of Chicago, South Side, to Jackie Robinson West baseball team. That should give that city some hope and some pause, that if we invest in our children and we show them and we give them an opportunity, that every time we are given an opportunity, we excel. And so what an awesome achievement for that team to make it to that level. And so for that, you know, my hat's off to them. Also, you know, just to go back to what we were talking about earlier with some of the police issues, where if you just Google what happened in Farney, Texas, where a call came over the police radio. They're looking for a tan car with four black males in it, and one of them was hanging out of the car waving a gun, allegedly. The cops pull over a red Nissan with the woman driving with her four kids in the car and pull her out the car and handcuffed her, and there's video of the whole thing. So, you know, how are you looking for a tan car and you pull over a red car with the female driver? And so it's non-ending. We just have to be aware. We have to stay on top of it. More importantly, we have whoever your divine power is, stay connected. You know, I pray every day. I pray and ask God every day for strength and wisdom to be able to discern different things going on. And so we just have to continue to do that one for another. I am excited. When we speak next Sunday, I will be giving an update on what happened at my book reading. Once again, it's on Saturday, August 30th, from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Woodbridge Golf Club here in Wiley, Texas. I look forward to it. Please stop by my Facebook page or tweet me at AskJema, that's A-S-K-J-E-M-A, if you have any questions about anything, you can visit our website at tailormade101.com/reflections if you're still wanting to purchase your book. So I'm just excited, and we'll hopefully have a great report to get back on Sunday.
Awesome. You know, I just saw the report from on Facebook. CBS News reported that, at least the title or the caption was, "No blacks have ever won the Little League World Series." And so it just goes to show you I talk about the media and how things are being portrayed, but they yet to leave out the full story about no blacks being able to participate in the Little League World Series, in 1955. And so, it just goes to show you the context of how the media portrays. And I don't want to let them off the hook, because it is important. The messaging is important. You know, what you say, how you say it, and the messaging is important. And again, for them to go out and just put that out there like that, without giving the whole full context of the story, to me is just not a good thing to do. So, but at any rate, another great show. I really appreciate all the hard work that you do, and people love this show because of you. So, keep up the good work. Well, that's our show for today. Now, I would like to thank all the listeners for tuning in. And, of course, a special thanks to the wonderful, the magnificent Jima Hill Cook. Now, don't forget to follow her on Twitter, and that's at Ask Jima. That's AskJEMA. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time, 5 o'clock Eastern. We are the number one resource for small businesses and nonprofits. Now, don't forget to bookmark this site and visit my blog, and that's at tailormadetalkradio.blogspot.com. Until next time, remember it is written, my people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge. So stay engaged, stay informed, and stay plugged in to Current Events with Patrick Cook. You're listening to the sounds of Joyce Spencer in Sweet Dreams. Take us away, Joyce.